having members give a little brief introduction, just before we get started. Obviously, you know, we all know that this came out of the expungement working group that met over the interim, that I was not the chair of. Representative Hillstrom was the chair of, and Senator Champion chaired as well. And but I had the privilege of carrying the bill through the House, and I think we came out with a pretty good bill as a result of that working group. And, you know, obviously we have some differences that we're going to work out here. What I sort of envision for today is to have staff walk us through the side-by-side and compare the House and Senate versions, and then take testimony from anyone that's here and wants to be heard. So with that, Senator Champion.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Moline, for all your great work on the House side. And I'm excited about the process that we took on the Senate side, and I think we have a great bill as well. And I'm pleased that my other Senate colleagues have agreed to be with us as well. So Senator Peterson and Senator Goodwin, and Senator Goodwin should be here momentarily, and but notwithstanding that, we are prepared to go forward, and thank you so much.
Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Senator Brandon Peterson from Northwest Anoka County, happy to be here. Feel really good about the process that we went about here. I thought it was very collaborative, and I credit Senator Champion to that, following up with me. It seemed like at times almost every other day. I think it's been a good process, and I think it's for the greater good that we're all here. So happy to be here.
Representative Cornish.
I'm Representative Cornish, District 23B, halfway between Mankato and Iowa.
Deborah Hillstrom, I chair the Judiciary Committee in the House, and I represent all the City of Brooklyn Center, parts of Brooklyn Park.
I'm halfway between Duluth and Canada. why don't we have staff introduce themselves, too?
You and House or Senate side first?
We can start with House side first.
Jeff Diebel, House Researcher.
Ken Back is Senate Counsel.
Kathy Potting is Senate Counsel.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Diebel, do you want to start with the walkthrough?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll start, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Potting to carry forward from there. Okay.
Mr. Diebel.
So everyone has their side-by-side. We'll start with two House-only provisions.
And if I might just interrupt you just quickly, Senator Goodwin has joined us. And we're excited to have her. And you can tell us what area you represent, and we're ready to go.
We just missed our brief introduction.
Oh, sorry. So. District 41, Columbia Heights, Fridley, St. Anthony Village, New Brighton, and Spring Lake Park.
All right.
Thank you.
We're ready.
Mr. Diebel's going to start out by going through the side-by-side. So, Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, we'll start on R1 of the side-by-side, and there's a summary that goes along with the comparison summary that you'll find in your materials, and I'll be working off of that as we work through the side-by-side language. As mentioned, the first two sections are House-only provisions. These both relate to the disclosure of expunged records by the Department of Human Services to stakeholders. So if someone applies for they do a background study and they fail because it is becoming an expunged offense, that information will be kept private by the department, so that even if they're not allowed to get the job because of the expunged offense, they wouldn't have to disclose it to the employer who's seeking it. So it's intended to protect some of the integrity of the expunged record by DHS. And that takes us through the first two sections. And Section 3 of the bill is one of the major substantive provisions on both sides, and this deals with juvenile expungement. And it gives the court's authority to expunge all records relating to arrest and delinquency proceedings rather than just the adjudication of the delinquency. And this stems from a recent Supreme Court case that restricted the scope an application of juvenile expungement to the court records. And so this would make it clear that it extends to executive branch records as well. On the House side, the area of exchanging or sharing these records is regulated so that juvenile records expunged prior to the effective date of what is enacted may be shared, may not be shared or exchanged, which is believed to be the current practice. And then moving forward, it would be governed by the provisions for sharing expunged records, which are discussed further down in the bill. On the Senate side, the substance of this provision is nearly identical. There's some technical drafting differences that refers to the arrest and delinquency proceedings, whereas the House just refers to the delinquency relating to delinquency. And then the House Senate also does not discuss the issue of exchanging records, and so it's silent on that, whereas the House keeps it as if you had your juvenile record expunged prior to the effective date, it's treated as it is now, but the Senate does not address that issue. And also, the Senate does not have a special effective date like the House does as of January 1st, 2015. Moving now to Section 4 on the House side, which is on R4. This has to do with business screening services, and it amends the law governing business screening services to require the screening service that knows of a criminal record that has been sealed or expunged or is subject to a pardon to promptly delete the record. And this is to make it clear that they need to keep their records up to date and current and reflect expunged or pardoned records. At this point, I'm going to ask, I think Ms. Ponte's going to take over on the side-by-side.
Madam Chair, members, in Section 5 of the House and Section 3 of the Senate are nearly identical. Both of these relate to expungements of evictions. And the main difference in the language, and it may be it's more of a stylistic, is on, if you look at, it's on R4 at the bottom of the page there. There's language in the Senate bill that refers to the expungement of records under Section 484.014, and this is actually the substantive law under which the eviction records can be expunged. And it also specifies that after the time that the judgment's entered, it could be done upon motion of the defendant. The House doesn't have the motion language. And I recall the reason the reference was added to 484.014 there was there were some questions were raised as to whether somehow this was expanding the substantive law dealing with expungements. And that's why the cross-reference back to that was included. If you go on to R5, this is kind of the guts of the bill, I guess. This basically expands the circumstances under which you can get a statutory expungement under current law. And the general framework is the same in both bills. Basically, they add the new categories to include persons who have successfully completed diversion or state of adjudication, or they include misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, and they also include certain lower level, like severity level 1 and 2 felony offenses. The biggest difference on R5 is the time periods that are applicable before someone's eligible to come in and bring a petition. The House has longer time periods.
Ms. Pontius, if you could hold just for a second, the Senate has to go vote.
Okay.
And so we'll be right back. So this may happen a lot this afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to count.
Really?
No sense to me.
I'm going to make some reference to caffeine having some calories. I'd say it's talking to calories.
That seems strange. I never heard that.
But it's like the, it's one that's variation on one that I got from Leanne and Ann.
Take public testimony. Uh-huh. So we know what they should or shouldn't.
Okay.
It's called the military
study. So
it's like this
one. Hey.
Ms. Pontius.
Here we go. You can start.
Ms. Pontius.
Okay. So we're back on R5. And again, the main difference between the two bills is the timelines before someone would be eligible to bring an expungement petition. In the cases of involving diversions or a stay of adjudications, the House language says at least 2 years have to have lapsed since completion, and the Senate is 1 year. And then for the various misdemeanor level offenses, the House is 5 years and the Senate is 3 years. And then for the felony level offenses, the House is 8 and the Senate is 5. And then after that, the bills are similar. There are a number of, with respect to the felony offenses that are eligible for expungement, there are a number of offenses that are still in the Senate language that I believe were taken out in the House. Because the Senate language started out with all the level 1 and 2 felony offenses, excluding like crimes of violence or crimes against persons. And that list remained the same, but the House took some out. And I think if you look at the summary, comparison summary on the top of page 4, there's a list of the crimes, a descriptive list of the ones that are still eligible for expungement under the Senate bill, but not the House bill. And then the next difference between the two bills is the House-only provision that appears on, excuse me, here, page R8, the paragraph C. I don't know if Mr. Debo wants to present that one then, or...
Madam Chair.
Mr. Diebel.
So R8 of the side-by-side House language, lines 7.27 through 7.31, the House-only provision, paragraph C, that prohibits the expungement of state sentences in cases of sexual or domestic abuse, stalking, and harassment until July 15, 2015. And then the House also has a special general effective date for that section of January 1st, 2015, which is not in the Senate language. Section 7 on the House side is deals with petitionless expungement, and it provides for expungement without the filing of a petition in certain cases where the prosecutor agrees to the sealing of a criminal record. And the Senate has an identical provision, except, again, the House has a special effective date of January 1st, 2015. Moving to R9 of the side-by-side, at the top on the House side, Section 8, there is identical language on the Senate side dealing with an exception for currently you can have a fee waived for filing a petition in certain expungement cases, and this makes it clear that that is not expanded to the new category of or new grounds for which you can seek an expungement. And this is makes the proposal cost neutral to the court so that they don't have to miss out on court filing fees for an expanded pool of expungement applications. So now we're moving on to
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Just a clarifying question. What was the fiscal note on the waiving of that fee, or did we find out how much that would cost if we were to leave that in for the...
$159,000.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, members, so we're still on page R9, moving now into the meat of the statutory expungement statute, and it's dealing with amending how you go about the standard for going about obtaining an expungement. This amendment to the language would add cases where the petitioner has successfully completed the terms of a diversion program to situations where the agency has the burden of proof. And so this has to deal with who has the burden coming in based on how the underlying case is procedurally postured. If the person had somehow or not would had the record reflected something that was determined in his or her favor, then the burden is on the government, and if it's not, the burden falls on the petitioner. The section also includes additional factors to be considered by the court in making its determination as to whether to grant an expungement. And the House includes more factors than the Senate, but they're very similar. The base language has remained relatively close. The one significant difference between the House and the Senate is that there was a floor amendment, I believe, on the House side that an expunged record must be disclosed as part of a mandated background check under statute, and the Senate has no comparable provision. And then the House also has a House-only provision that prohibits expunged records from being introduced in civil litigation against an employer or landlord for alleged misconduct of an employee or tenant. And again, there's no comparable provision in the Senate language. And then finally, the House carries forward its special effective date of January 1st, 2015 for this section, and the Senate does not have a similar special effective date. The Section 10, moving to R10 of the side-by-side, is a House-only provision that creates special protections for persons who have a record expunged and the person is deemed a victim. And there is a nexus between the expunged record and the person's status as a victim. And that's a provision that was added, I believe, in committee through the on the House side. But, again, there's no comparable provision.
Could I have that explained a little bit more, please, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr.
Understand that.
Do you want me to explain it? Or Mr. Diebel can. I believe that what we were trying to get at, and this language came from the domestic violence advocates, that sometimes people find themselves in a situation where, you know, they get into a fight or an argument, and the person who is actually the victim in a domestic violence situation ends up being charged and convicted of a crime. So this allows the situation where if a person can petition the court and, you know, meet all these other factors, and then that they also show that, you know, their status as a crime victim in a sort of domestic situation had to do with the underlying crime, that the court considers that as well.
Thank you.
Is that correct, Mr. Diebel?
Yeah, I would defer to perhaps the testimony to explain it further, but I think that seemed like a good explanation.
Thank you, and I know that we have some people here, so maybe they can talk about it, too, when they testify. So. Mr. Diebel?
On page R11 of the side-by-side, top on the House side, this is a little bit confusing because of the way the two bills diverged in how their path, but on the House side, it amends the language to, as you see in R11 and onto R12 is actually the amendment. That's on top of R12. It basically says that the standards for sharing expunged records between law enforcement are the current standards for if your record was expunged prior to the January 1st, 2015, and that requires a court order. And I'm going to defer to Ms. Pontius to explain the differences for records that how the Senate handled this issue and then how the House deals with records that are expunged after that date.
Oh, the senators need to go vote, so we'll get to Ms. Pontius as soon as they get back.
But we're almost done with the side-by-side, I can see that. We'll just probably get excuses.
Russians are coming.
Let's get John over here.
John,
come on over here.
Yeah, you can do that for him. I'm staying down here until my own bill comes up. No need to do that. So I got excused until my own bill comes up.
Ms. Pontius, or Senator Peterson, did you have a question?
Not related to the bill.
Okay. Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair and members, I'll pick up where Mr. Debo left off, which is the House makes a distinction between when the records are expunged and basically retains current law up to January 1 of 2015. So it's a little odd in the drafting where you see this one section that's really current law. The way as the drafting style, the way it does it then is to have a whole new section of law that would kick in on January 1, 2015. The Senate language just doesn't address application one way or the other, and it doesn't have a special effective date. So, you know, it would be the default August 1 of 2014. And, you know, a number of the provisions in here in the amendments were tied to the sort of the assumption that the grounds for getting an expungement would be expanded, but there was never discussion on the Senate side as far as drawing a line in terms of when the new law would kick in and what kind of records would be covered. So, and then in terms of actual substantive differences between the language, you sort of have to jump from R11 on the Senate side to R12 on the House side. So I'll try to sort of point out the differences. If you look at R11 on the Senate side on 8.1 to 8.4, this is a provision that went on the Senate floor. It allows the opening of an expunged record of a conviction for purposes of teacher background checks and background checks of other school professionals that are done either by the Board of Teaching or the Department of Education. So that's not in the House bill. And then if you look at paragraph D of the Senate language, which is on 8.17 to 8.20, that's a data destruction requirement. So when an agency gets an expunged record and no longer needs it for the purposes for which it was obtained, it has to destroy it. That is not in the House bill. And then let's see, if you look at... then just the effective date, which we already discussed. So those are the main differences between those two sections. I don't think I missed any. Mr. Diebel, do you see?
No, I don't see.
And then section 13 on the House side and section 9 on the Senate side are identical, except this is the requirements as far as distributing and confirming expungement orders. It's just the delayed effective date in the House. And then Section 10 on the Senate side is a remedy, and that's not in the House bill. And this provides that an individual whose record is expunged can basically have the remedies that are available for violations of the Data Practices Act. So it just cross-references Section 13.08. Because the way that section is worded, it technically only applies to violations of Chapter 13, and an expungement order isn't a violation of Chapter 13. So this would provide a remedy in cases where a record was opened or exchanged in a manner not authorized by law. And then the last differences are just in the money. I think they're pretty much the same between the two. The appropriations, I think both are $600,000 for public safety. Human services, the Senate is $98,000, whereas the House is $82,000. And that's all I have. I don't know if Mr. Diebel has anything since I missed.
Mr. Diebel?
No, ma'am.
Mr. Diebel, just for the... the fact that we have different effective dates throughout, is that because we did the provisions where expungements that have already happened are treated under current law, and going forward, expungements are treated under the new access provisions, or is there a different reason we have the different effective dates?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding of why the effective dates were set to allow for the sharing of the data and allow them to people time to implement those new standards for sharing the records. I think there were some concerns at BCA about getting their system programmed so that they could do that. But again, we could ask them. I know they're in the room.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask a question about the Section 10 on the Senate side, the civil remedy for individuals who expunged records opened or exchanged in a manner not authorized by law. So is that penalty, other than under the Data Practices Act, is that type of penalty anywhere else in statute under any other conditions for the government to have to pay? Or is this, because typically with the Data Practices Act, if you violate the Data Practices Act, does that penalty then just apply to government actors, or does that apply to private citizens and then with this as well? So if I get access to an expunged record and I distribute it in an improper fashion, is that a penalty on a private person as well?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I would read it as a penalty on anyone who violated. And then so it wouldn't be.
Is there anywhere else in the statute where that is the case as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the only thing I can think of is there have been a few times in the law where we had sharing of data, government data, with a private person, and there were concerns that once it gets out of the hands of the private person, they can do what they want with it, even if it was otherwise private. So sometimes in those cases, I know there are a few statutes out there that actually piggyback on to 13.08 and say if the private person releases it in violation of the law, then they're subject to those remedies as well. But you need some kind of a hook there to tie in to get that remedy to apply.
Other questions from members? We don't have a list of.
Maybe you might want to start with the BCA for the effective date so they can answer that question of the effective dates and that'll lead into some of their other concerns that they'd want to consider.
Yeah, we don't have a list of testifiers or any particular order, but I think if we could start with the BCA if they want to come up first go through some of the provisions, especially in regards to that effective date issue. Ms. Engler, if you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Thank you for the opportunity to share with the other members of the conference committee the issues we've raised with you about implementation of the policy before that you have in your bills. In particular, the Bureau would appreciate for the areas where the Bureau has work to do to have the January 1, 2015 effective date. We have a fair amount of computer programming, about 12 weeks worth, that we need to do. And we also need to find the employees to be able to respond to the petitions that we know will be served with once this becomes effective. So we would greatly appreciate that at least for some of the provisions where the Bureau has work to do, that we have a January 1 effective date, and I can get that list to council of those sections.
Thank you.
We
have a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you tell me, so the effective date for your later implementation isn't for later implementation of the actual expungement, it's for later implementation of you providing the records to other entities, or would it actually delay the expungement of your records as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the delay is about, number one, us being able to do the computer programming to get ready to do the exchange that's in both bills. Secondly, also, we get served with all of these petitions, and we have to have staff go through, review the criminal history record in question, determine if an objection needs to be filed. So we do a lot of work as far as informing the court about the process, and we literally need some time to get the people discovered and hired and trained so that we're ready, assuming the January 1 effective date is implemented for the new eligibility for expungement, we'll be ready to respond to the demand we anticipate we're going to see.
And, yeah, I think, Representative Hillstrom, I think our effective date for the entire bill is January 1st, 2015. Is that correct, Mr. Debo? I know it says it in several different places, but... So we wouldn't run into the scenario where the effective date of petitions would be sooner than the effective date for the BCA. From my understanding, the effective date of the entire bill is January 1st, 2015. Correct, Mr.
Debo? Madam Chair, I don't believe some of the provisions can go into effect immediately because they don't affect the BCA.
Okay.
So I think the intent was to identify the provisions where the BCA needed the additional time. And those are the ones that deal with the expanded grounds for expungement that they anticipate leading to an increased workload. But other provisions regarding the business screening services, and I should double check on that one, but some of the provisions should have a standard effective date to because they won't burden the BCA.
Thank you.
Looking at House Section 3, which is on R3, and the comparable provision in the Senate is Section 1. This is the juvenile adjudication language. Mr. Diebel pointed this out earlier. The House uses the phrase "all records relating to delinquency," whereas the Senate language relating to arrest and delinquency leaves some records that would not be subject to the seal order. And from an implementation perspective, the House language allows us to seal everything rather than to just a portion of the juvenile adjudication record. House Section 6, which is on page R5, and it's Senate Section 4, which is on that same page, focusing on the phrase "convicted of or received a stayed sentence for." This affects how you count or how you determine which crimes are eligible under what provision. And the example I'm going to use is someone is charged with a felony burglary offense, but the sentence imposed is for a gross misdemeanor. Do you want the eligibility determined by the sentence that has been imposed or by the offense level at the time of charge? And I just need to raise that issue with you because it will affect how people evaluate whether or not a particular offense, particularly the felonies, are eligible for expungement. In House Section 7 and Senate Section 5, which is on R8, this is the sealing without the need for a petition. The BCA would appreciate it if there was language added at the end to direct the court administrator to send a copy of the order sealing the record to each agency and jurisdiction whose records are affected by the terms of the order. That would be the only way we'd know that the record had been sealed since there was no petition.
Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
What you're saying is that you want to be specifically named in that section so that you make sure and get copies of the records, or am I not understanding what it is that you're asking for?
Ms. Engler.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, what we're really asking for is direction to the court to send us the order so that we know the order exists.
That makes sense.
And not just us, but anyone affected by the order.
Right. That makes sense.
Is it a fiscal cost?
Because they always support the Senate notice.
I thought we had something to that effect in the bill.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. She just wants it identified in that section. That there is a section where notice is supposed to be provided to agencies. But what I think Ms. Engler is speaking to is the fact that if you don't tell the courts to do something, they may not always just do what they're supposed to do. That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, what I'm recalling is retired Justice Paul Anderson's comments to the working group, where he said, if you want the courts to do something, tell us what you want us to do.
Yeah. Great, you did.
That's a paraphrase, but that was the gist of his message. The next issue we identified from an implementation perspective is in, it's only in Senate Section 8, and this is the language on R11, beginning at the end of 8.14, the concept of destroying records once they're no longer needed. The concern that the Bureau identified is that if the criminal justice agency goes and gets the sealed record because they need it for purposes of enhancement of the currently pending offense, it becomes part of that case record. Mm-hmm. And if we're then told, or if the law enforcement agency is then told, once the case investigation becomes inactive, which is a term of art kind of from Chapter 13, you're telling the law enforcement agency to get rid of the basis for the enhanced penalty, so you've changed the official documentation for that subsequent offense case file. And so I think there's a way to fix the issue, which is to not allow people to accumulate records that are otherwise sealed, and create another repository of that information without directing folks who have a case where the sealed record was used as part of the enhancement to keep that as part of their case file. And I can provide some language if people would like that.
And Madam Chair, if I might.
This is
Senator Peterson's amendment, and it's my understanding, and I did share with others that I believe his intent was, and he can speak to this much more clearly than I can, was that he didn't want law enforcement agencies to build up their own repositories of information outside of this the official BCA database, and so that was his concern, and so. And so I just wanted that to be clear, and then I think Senator Peterson can tell me if I'm right or wrong and whether we can get this language that helps.
That's correct, and you addressed that at the end of your statement, and certainly I think there's a fairly easy way around that, and I'm open to doing that.
The next issue is in House Section 9 on page R10. Specifically, the language in 9.23 through 9.25 related to directing the Bureau to tell a statutorily mandated or tell an agency conducting a statutorily mandated check that a sealed record exists but not to disclose the content. There may be some outcomes that were not intended by the language, specifically. Someone doing a statutorily mandated check may choose to disqualify a candidate because they don't know the content of that sealed record, and so rather than benefiting the applicant, it in fact is going to harm them because they can't tell what was sealed does not have an impact on that particular check. As an example, a school district wants to hire an athletic coach for the football team, so they're doing a mandated check. The coach has a sealed record for misdemeanor shoplifting, which arguably has nothing to do with his or her interactions with students, but the school district doesn't know that it's a shoplifting offense, and so they're not going to, or they're potentially going to disqualify that individual because they don't know what's in the record.
Sangler, if you could hold that thought, and then senators are going
to. I'm not voting on that.
Do you need the vote?
There's the final passage of Hoffman.
No, he's fine.
Sorry.
Ms. Hengler, and that provision in particular that we're discussing was one of those that got thrown on the House floor at sort of the last minute without a lot of forethought. And I think that, you know, after further investigation, there are quite a few unintended consequences associated with that. So take a look at that.
Madam Chair, the next concern is in House Section 11, which is on R11, and Senate Section 8. I'm sorry, we don't have to talk about that one. House Section 12, which is on R12, specifically. The language in 11.12 through 11.16, it's my understanding that the intent of this language was that when the basis for the expungement was that the underlying case had been resolved in the petitioner's favor, that after January 1, 2015, would still require an ex parte court order to get access to that record. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that's what the language that there actually says, and so I'm happy to try to come up with some alternative language to get to the heart of that concept in a way that I think everyone would be able to understand, so they'd know when they need to go get an ex parte court order.
Yeah, and I think that obviously, under the new language, there's no ex parte court order required for accessing expunged records by criminal justice agencies, you know, under certain circumstances. And the intent of this language was that going forward, if somebody was acquitted of a charge, say, or a charge was dismissed due to lack of probable cause or something along those lines, that access would require the ex parte court order. The language is a little confusing, though. I think there's a double negative, maybe. But it wouldn't allow, it wouldn't require the ex parte court order if, say, you were charged with five offenses and as part of your plea deal, three of them were dismissed and you pled on two. That's where that language, same circumstances, same set of facts or circumstances. So in that case, that the access still would be there without the ex parte court order on those sorts of dismissed charges. I think that was the intent of the language when we added it in one committee along the way. But if we need to sort of clear it up a little bit so it's not so confusing, that might be helpful.
Yes.
Very confusing.
And those are the end, that's the end of the BCA implementation issues.
Are there questions from members?
All right.
Senator Goodwin?
Maybe just to explain on that same section 12, what is the language in 11.19 to 11.22? What is the purpose of that? What kind of a background study are we talking about?
I think, isn't this, wouldn't this be the same language that the Senate has regarding new access to expunged records?
I can't remember what we did.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Good, that's actually current law in terms of the Commissioner of Human Services getting access. The only difference I'll note, I just realized looking at this, there's a couple other House-only provisions that I missed when I was going through this, but yes. The House has language that the commissioner have been properly served with the notice of the petition. But otherwise, it's consistent with current.
This appears to be an emergency.
Those are House only ones, I think, that aren't from the Senate. That I forgot to put in the summary. The one we were just talking about, and then also the victim.
But so we're going to send Ms. Goodwin back, Senator Goodwin.
That's just something to think about later. All right.
Ms. Engler, I don't think we have any more questions for the BCA.
I'll be
at
here.
This time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you, if you're in the audience and you plan on testifying, can you just raise your hand and so we get a sort of an idea? Okay. Mr. Kerber, 6. Mr. Kerber, do you want to come up next?
Hello, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services in the Inspector General's office. And I thought I might just point out a couple of provisions where there's a difference in the ones that we really like. In the House language, sections 1 and 2 are directives to the agency as to how to handle information about a person who's received an expungement, where we would otherwise be required. So under the scenario, of course, there are expungement orders, and sometimes they apply to the Commissioner of Human Services and sometimes they don't. And so if we're dealing with a person who has an expunged record that isn't applying to the department, but nevertheless it's expunged for all other purposes, there's a provision in the House language that we were attending to that says that an expunged record that is opened or exchanged. Pardon me?
Mr. Kerber, if you could just point out where you're reading.
Okay. Yes, I'm sorry, members. It's subdivision 7, so it's R11 in the Senate language, section 8.
R11 or R1?
R11 in the language. So in R11, lines 8.15 and 8.16, where it, in the Senate language, It's talking about when a record, when an expunged record is in the hands of somebody else, it remains expunged. And so, in trying to figure out how that would apply to us, the amendment here in sections 1 and 2 in the House language really addresses that. When we're doing background studies under Chapter 245C, sometimes generally the criminal history information on an individual is private data. However, there are some scenarios where that information becomes public, and then there's other scenarios where we are required to disclose it to the employer. And so it becomes public if it's a disqualification for particular crimes. And so one of these provisions makes it clear that if the person meets that criteria, they're disqualified for one of those crimes in one of those settings, where it would otherwise become public data at the time they get a set-aside. If they have an order of expungement, it doesn't. It remains private data. So it continues to protect that information on the individual if they have an order of expungement. The other one is when we disqualify an individual and that individual requests a reconsideration of that disqualification and they're given a set-aside, the law provides that we will then tell the employer why the person had the disqualification and why it was set aside. If they have an expungement that applies in other settings, these two provisions make it clear that we wouldn't tell the employer either. We would tell the employer that the person has a record that's sealed. So that was an attempt to get some language in here that would kind of direct us as to how to implement that, sort of the traveling nature of this of the expungement order.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. My question is, why would you need to tell somebody that they had a record and it was sealed?
Mr. Kramer.
What we're telling them, I think the language says that the record, so we're already telling them that we're telling the employer that the individual had a disqualification. The law requires that we inform the employer that the person has a disqualification and then kind of what the rights are of the individual. The individual can then request a reconsideration of that disqualification. And in many cases, they get a set-aside of that disqualification. So then they can go to work. The law then makes it clear that we need to tell the employer why the person was disqualified. And so if we're not going to implement that part of the law because the person has an expungement order, then we need that directive in here to tell us not to inform the employer.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Kerber, if it wasn't a disqualifying crime, do you still tell them that there was an expunged record?
Madam Chair, no.
Okay.
No. No. When we do a background study on an individual, an individual is either disqualified or they're not disqualified as far as our communication with the employer. And then if a person requests a set-aside and they receive that set-aside, it's only at that point that the person, that there's more information that's disclosed. And so the concept of the legislature at that time was that a person could walk away with their privacy intact. And so, you know, they can go through our background study system, and if they're going to get a disqualification and they don't want anybody to know what it is, they can exit the whole process here without anybody knowing why they were disqualified. There's a couple of exceptions. If it's a disqualification for maltreatment, the employer's going to find out at that first notice. But otherwise, that was sort of the concept. And so this sort of just builds on that.
Senator Goodwin.
Basic question, Madam Chair. So I want to know how that would work in relation to somebody that's trying to get a license for nursing or other healthcare fields. If they've had their record expunged, you still will be telling them that they have a sealed record, that they have some kind, even if it's not a disqualifying offense, that would automatically disqualify from their job, like, you know, assault or something like that on their record. No matter what the crime was, you would still judge whether or not they could get a license based on a sealed, expunged record.
Mr. Gerber, members and Senator Goodwin, I should clarify the background studies that we do for the Department of Human Services are related to our licensing of facilities and services. So, we don't do the background studies really for purposes of the health-related licensing boards determining whether an individual should be licensed.
Okay.
That's sort of separate from this. We do background studies on the individuals as they're employed by nursing homes or hospitals or home health agencies or anywhere essentially in the healthcare or human services industry. We will do background studies on those people, but it's not related to their individual professional licensure. Okay, but if then to your question, as it relates to those background studies that we do. If the crime we see in the criminal record is not one of the disqualifying crimes under Chapter 245C, then the person is not disqualified and the employer doesn't find out about it.
I think I get it now. Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Gerber? So for clarity, are you saying you like any particular language here, or you are saying you just want some directive as to how to deal with this, for lack of a better word, this narrow issue that you have raised?
Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is that the House language for Sections 1 and 2, where there's not corresponding language in the Senate bill, those two sections in the House language are very good for us.
Okay, got you.
Okay.
All right.
And then Section 12 of the House language also has, I think as you've talked about a little bit, just has a clarifying provision for convenience, and I think Senator Goodwin, this is what you had talked about a moment ago, where it just clarifies that for an expungement order to apply to the commissioner, there really are two prongs. One is that we have to have been served with notice of the petition, and second, the final order has to identify the commissioner. And so that's already in parallel law. That's already in Chapter 245C. But when it hasn't been, that first prong hasn't been in expungement law, it's caused some problems for people. And so it's really so that people who are looking only at the expungement law to figure out how they're going to do their expungement will see that both of these really apply. And so they'll do a better job of requesting the expungement. So we like the House language on that, too.
So Section 12, the House language
yes.
as well.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
There's one other provision that we would like to see, and that's really related to making it clear that the Department of Human Services has the authority to give the court private data in our response to an order, to a petition for expungement. So... you know, at the Department of Human Services, the default classification for all data that we have on individuals is that it's private data. And so when there's a petition for an expungement and we need to respond to the court, there are times when we need to give information to the court that we have, and sometimes it's information that we've created. It might be the individual's background study history with us or other information that we've learned about the individual that we think is important for the court to know. However, that information is private. And so what we would like to see is just get a little cover in here saying that we may, notwithstanding any other provision of Chapter 13, we may release that information to the court for purposes of responding to a petition. Okay? And we have some draft language to that effect that we've talked with others about.
Representative Hielstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what do you do now? Do you have that authority to release that private data now when someone requests an expungement?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hielstrom, we release it now. And as we've been talking about this a lot more lately, we've come to realize that we may be releasing information that without really adequate cover.
Any other questions for Mr. Gerber? And I'm sure that Ms. Pontius and the others are taking down these notes feverishly for us. Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, I might just add that along with that, members, what we would like to see is one more small amendment that would make it clear that we will inform the court that information is private data, and so that the court can be informed and consider a protective order on that information. Because even though that information is private in our hands, once we give it to the court, the default classification is as public information. So ironically, somebody petitioning for sealing of the record might actually be, the result may be that there's a disclosure of more information about the individual because of the public data filed. And so we would like somehow there to be a process, and I think some other possible testifiers want to talk to that effect, too.
And Mr. Gerber, do you have any language that you think would be helpful for us on these
Mr.
issues?
Chair, yes, we've proposed some language. I shared it with Representative Moline, and I don't think it's drafted yet, but it could be.
So if we could ask you at least to give us some proposed language or work with Senate counsel or House counsel so that we can at least consider it. All right?
Gladly do that. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Gerber? Seeing none, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right. Is this to this issue? Okay. And as you approach, or once you approach, if you identify yourself for the record, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Melinda Hugdahl with Legal Aid. This is specifically to the last issue that Mr. Kerber referenced. He and I have had a couple of conversation about a potential amendment about this disclosure of data. And from the start, I want to acknowledge part of this is that we run up to the fact that Chapter 13 does not apply to the courts. So once things become part of a court file, that's the court rules about what's public and not under their own rules. So we're trying to recognize that. One thing we'd like to see if there is some consideration of this is a notice to the petitioner that this data is going to be disclosed, maybe 10 days in advance from the agency to the person petitioning for expungement saying, hey, we're going to be disclosing what is private data to the courts, which now will make it public unless someone brings some kind of a request for a protective order. Because the language that I think the department's considering, and I understand the intent completely, really just takes care of the department's potential disclosure of private information. It doesn't do anything to further or prompt anyone really to do a motion for a protective order once it gets to the court file. So we'd like to see, in addition, the agency be required to notify the petitioner of, hey, we're going to disclose what's private information now, and it will become public unless someone does something.
Ms. Hugdahl, have you determined or thought about the fiscal implication of what you're requesting?
I've had a very brief conversation with Mr. Kerber about that piece of it. Obviously, there are going to be notices the agency is sending out now, and I'm sure Mr. Kerber will advise us as to if there's a significant fiscal cost. I mean, this is a significant change for the department already, and we would think it'd be a fairly small notice. But I do recognize that, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else that has a question for Ms. Hugdahl? Is that the only issue?
That was our only issue in this piece. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Ms. Haas. If you'd be so kind as to identify yourself for the record and
I'm a friend.
And go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I have with me Phil Prokopowicz from the Dakota County Attorney's Office. Just to start really briefly and say thank you for all of your work on this bill. The County Attorneys Association is extremely supportive of this expungement legislation. We have four areas and maybe now five to just chat with you about related to implementation, not related to substance, but just some suggestions to you on how, from a practitioner's perspective, this bill could work maybe just a tiny bit better with a couple of changes.
Okay.
I think first that I will go to is on page R13 and section 9 in the Senate, section 13 in the House. One of the things that we're concerned about, and this actually touches on, we care, I think, a lot about the resolution that comes up between DHS and Legal Aid related to giving information to petitioners or being required to give information to petitioners. And specifically in this section, I think the goal of this is to make sure petitioners know that their records are expunged and that the agencies that have information on them is then expunged. What we had suggested is making sure that that you request in the petition to the court administrator that is expunged. So then we have the contact information, and it makes us complying with this a lot easier. And so we have some language that we can share with you related to that.
That'd be great.
The next area is on page R11. This was the issue that we talked about. This is the Senator Peterson amendment that was raised before. I think we're very supportive of the idea that the information that we get and access should only be utilized for that particular purpose. Although we're a little concerned about the language that talks about destroying the record when we're done, we have some suggested language because we have to keep some files and some information for a longer period of time related specifically to the reason we requested the information that we'll get, hopefully, at the same goal of what Senator Peterson added to the bill. So we have some language we can share with you on that.
And you did also hear Ms. Engler also talk about that. She has some suggested language on that as well.
We're fully supportive of the intent behind it, but have a little bit better suggestion for how to accomplish it. The third area is on R11 of the House and R12 in the Senate. This relates to the access without a court order and the sharing of the information by criminal justice agencies. We think that an extra sentence at the end of that language would be helpful to us.
And where in particular are you looking?
Sure.
So you said R11?
For the House.
R11 on the House, so it would be after line 7.30. And I'll just read it really quickly, but I'll explain the use of it. Nothing in this chapter shall act to limit the use of expunged records by criminal justice agencies in investigative reports, court proceedings, probation supervision related to subsequent offenses. And so that has to do with in subsequent times when we need to use the information that we've accessed for circumstances down the road. And maybe Phil Prokopowicz can give a couple of examples for you.
Chair, members of the committee.
And if you can identify yourself for the record, please.
Philip Prokopowicz. I'm the Chief Deputy Dakota County Attorney on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Some of this data and the advantage of getting the sharing of the criminal justice agencies is we in turn have to use this data in what's potentially public records. I think it was kind of referenced in previous testimony before the committee, such as an application for a search warrant, an affidavit in support of an application for a search warrant, or a motion to bring in evidence of additional crimes. We have to identify what those crimes were in that type of thing. That then goes into the court record. We want to have the ability to make sure that we have the ability to do that. And those records, as previously mentioned before the committee, aren't subject to Chapter 13. We need that ability, without fear of any type of liability or anything of that nature, to use that data for its original intended purposes of why we searched it.
All right. Any questions of the testifier?
Yes.
If you'll hold there just for one moment, we have to see if we have to vote. We have to all vote?
It's the Nelson bill. We were told you wanted to vote on the Nelson bill.
Is that the bill?
No.
My bill next? Oh.
My bill is a good bill.
Yes, Remini, and then
I'm
going to recess the committee to the call of the chair.
I assume it's just like a
I was watching Leo and Greg are back. I don't remember that. I was on the living room one day.
Tell the call of the chair, but I suppose when Joe comes back, here's Joe.
See how good I am, you guys?
No.
You have to start.
They got a little messed up because they were supposed to have me next and they didn't. But, okay, go ahead.
No, you have to start it up again because Deb recessed.
Oh, she did?
She had to call to order.
I think she just went to the.
Oh.
Not allowed.
So someone has to go to the restroom, they just recess us out.
Only when you're not here.
Not in there, Carly.
A simple one that Limmer did in 2011 is for informa properis. It's just making sure it's clear as to the fact that judges can waive a fee or something for filing. But if the person gets a windfall of money later, that a judge can say, oh, well, at the time I did this, you didn't have any money, but now you have some money. That's all it is. Nothing big.
It starts off.
What do you include for the Indian people with indigency? The waiver of the fee, $79,000.
In here?
Yeah.
By mistake.
Yeah, I figure you guys are spending like $1.2
billion. No, so we can't do that.
For the people who can't.
No. A lot of that is going in the reserve.
Yeah, my good friend Brandon knows that. If I could, I'd be like, hey.
Is there something? No, it was a serious question, though.
No, because that you can just go apply for one and the fees are waived.
Right.
You still have the ability if you are indigent and can't do it under the informa pauperis procedures to be able to get the fees waived. What I feel was doing before was just automatically waiving it and say, hey, if you want to put in.
Yeah, no, but I thought I heard from the staff that says under the new scope of items that can be expunged, those do not apply to a waiver.
Small ones are pretty small.
That's what I thought I heard.
No, we had an automatic waiver before.
Was I incorrect in
So there was an automatic waiver before, which was on the cost support. They thought approximately $159,000.
This one? So that was taken out.
He said the way he said it was not the way he said it.
That's the way we understood it on our side of the equation.
In there for the exit.
We always have the ability to form a properties.
Oh, sorry. So the grounds for indigency are limited to on page R8. Or is it R? Maybe it goes all the way back to R7.
Yeah, so there's an additional
six.
So the R8 or R6?
R8 and R6 is all a list of.
Yeah, that's why it's going way back to.
Subdivision 3, paragraph A, clause 1.
So law currently gives a break to people that have had their records resolved in their favor.
Oh, I see.
So if you're indigent and they're saying that it's really not your fault, you were absolved of responsibility for this offense, you shouldn't be then charged a fee if you're poor. And so what the language is trying to do is say, yes, we're going to keep that narrow exception to the filing fee for indigent people because...
Which is damages.
I'd have to look in your favor. You were wrongfully brought into the criminal justice system. You should now be taxed to expunge the record. Now, these other offenses, so you had a felony, but you've been law-abiding for X number of years. You don't deserve the benefit.
That's what the policy
says. But it's to say that...
And 1309 is...
It wasn't intended to extend that exception. So if you're poor and you weren't convicted, you should...
Following it very closely.
I
think that's the issue.
So
for example, like let's say
300.
Yeah, it's a lot.
That's good. Yeah,
that's
good. Yeah,
that's good. That is a lot of money.
If you are,
Phil can screw it up.
I could screw it up.
Now I bet as soon as I gavel this back
there, looking at this next month's record.
Bobby tried to steal your.
I will call the committee back to order. Thank you so much for that brief recess, we can pick up where we left off, and I think you had a couple more issues, Ms. Haas?
One more, Mr. Chair. Page R13 of the Senate language, the Section 10, the remedy conversation that we had earlier, and we were just recalling the discussion we had in the Senate committee on this, and we just noticed that we need a cross-reference or to add the words knowingly or recklessly. This was the issue we discussed previously, that if you want to go down this path, what we are hoping for is that a standard for a, you know, if a mistake happens by an employee or something, that that there is a standard in terms of going after that employee that they had to knowingly or recklessly open or exchange the expunged record. And when we were in the Senate committee, I think folks thought that the reference to Section 1308 had that covered, but that's only with respect to damages. And if you were to go to 1309 for employees, that's where the standard for willful or reckless distribution. So we'd encourage you, that if you're going to go down this path, to think about that cross-reference or adding the terms knowingly or recklessly.
All right. Any questions of the testifiers? Seeing none, thank you so very much. We appreciate your testimony. And if you would identify yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I'm also joined up here by Liz Richards from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We just figured we'd handle both of our issues here at the same time and testify about them. But what I wanted to do was just provide a little more information on the sections that have to do with crime victims. Senator Goodwin, you had a question about that, and the explanation given is right on point, but I thought I'd just give you a little more background, too, if that's okay. I first would like to thank Representative Moline for including this in the House version, and we've had good conversations with Senator Champion about this section as well, and understand he is supportive, too, so we really appreciate that.
Yeah, I recall that from an email. I recall that.
Thank you. So I will give you just a couple of references in the side-by-side on page R9. You'll see in lines, actually line 9-7, there is some language that says context and circumstances, and that is different from the language that is in the Senate side. And we had requested that that piece be added in order to support the language that's on the next page on R10, which starts at line 10.1.
And hold it, before you go on, where is it on R9?
9-7.
9-7, okay.
Context and circumstances. Okay. And then when you go to R10, starting at line 10.1, you'll see context and circumstances mentioned there as well. And essentially what we wanted to do was to create a section that recognizes that some defendants are also victims and that the crime they may have been convicted of is related to their victimization. You had provided an example of domestic abuse. That's a good example. This also came up when we were speaking to advocates who work with victims of trafficking and prostitution. They may have actually been convicted of prostitution while in a trafficking ring, for example, and it's a result of their victimization. So
and
essentially,
just for clarity, is it true, based on the language that's in our provisions, that if a person is a victim and ends up being charged with a crime, like, let's say, domestic assault or something like that, that they will never, ever get heard on this matter unless it's after July of 2015, because that person would be prohibited from coming in court and making that connection between their offense of being charged with, let's say, domestic assault, right? Because that's my understanding.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct with regard to that particular offense.
Okay.
But other victim-related offenses, prostitution, for example, they could go ahead before that date.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there some clearer way we can say what's being said there? I mean, maybe lawyer types understand that, but maybe courts understand it, but it just seems to be more complex language than we really need to have. Is there, does it make any sense to cite specific, because I understand totally what you're saying about sex trafficking and domestic abuse, but is there some way we can, maybe I should ask our counsel this, we can clarify that language, or is it necessary to add some of those specific examples, you think?
And maybe what would help is that if I let the testifier continue, because I think I cut her off before she was able to put in context the language there, and then that gives counsel an opportunity to think through your question, Senator Goodwin. So, testifier, if you might continue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, I think I can answer that. So the language we provided is that if a petitioner is coming forward and asking for a remedy under this particular section, they have to show a nexus between the particular crime they were convicted of and their victimization. The reason why we didn't list out particular crimes is, again, and it really was talking a lot in the trafficking and prostitution context, sometimes victims of trafficking are convicted of a number of different types of crimes aside from prostitution, maybe theft, something else that's furthering the ring's goals. And it just seemed like if we made a list, we probably might leave something out. Mm-hmm. So we left it a little bit broad
that
in order
sense.
To accommodate
it
that.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. It makes sense.
And Mr. Chair, additionally, just a couple more pieces. The person who would qualify under this particular section, if the court agrees and says that they see a nexus, they can request a sworn statement from an advocacy program saying that the person is receiving services there as a crime victim. And also, if the court does grant this type of expungement, then the person would be returned back to the status they had prior to the arrest and conviction.
Any questions of the testifier? If not, Ms. Richards?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. Just one other quick piece in the crime victim categories. We just want to come forward, and this is talking about in Section 6 of the House file, R8, I believe, lines 727 to 731. This is the section where domestic abuse crimes are exempted from consideration for expungement until July of 2015. We just wanted to make it clear that we support this language that's in the House file. And I know, Senator Champion, we've been in discussion about this as well, but just wanted to be clear to the committee as a whole that we've raised a number of concerns trying to look at where are the ways in which expungement of a domestic violence crime, where somebody might need to get back into that sealed record in avenues other than in the criminal justice system. And so we have, and a domestic violence conviction really is considered the best evidence of a history of domestic violence, and that's why it's concerning to us. So we know that in family court proceedings, when custody comes up, sometimes use of that conviction is helpful. We know that in the immigration arena, under relief available under the Violence Against Women Act, sometimes people need to prove their domestic violence victimization. And also within tax proceedings under innocent spouse relief, sometimes it comes up in those arenas. And we engage in a lot of discussion trying to think what would be the right language that would both give access in the appropriate other hearings that wouldn't sort of undercut the whole reason behind getting an expungement. And we weren't really able to come up with language that we didn't think might create more problems. So that's why really this was looking at saying give us time to try and work these things through before you put domestic violence crimes into the crimes available for expungement. And that's why we are supportive of the House file language.
And just for clarity, Ms. Richards, we have talked about it and that we are going to get some language over to you for your consideration.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Absolutely. Any other questions of these two wonderful testifiers? If nothing else, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. Anyone else wants to testify? Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry McDonough. I'm pro bono counsel with Dorsey & Whitney. I'm here to talk about the sole landlord-tenant provision that's in here, which I believe is let me just pull it up here. I forgot to bring paper, so but I have a computer. It is Section 5 in, I believe, the House bill, Section 3 in the Senate. And I've been a landlord-tenant practitioner for about 30 years. I'm also a landlord, so I can kind of see this from both sides. I'm just speaking on behalf of the
Just for the record, I believe it's R4. Is that the page, I believe? Mm-hmm. R4. Okay. For the committee's reference. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry about that. I'm speaking in favor of the House version rather than the Senate version. The Senate version is a little more specific in terms of a cross-reference. The reason why I'm speaking in favor of the House version is that there are two types of expungement that happen in housing court. One is under the statute that's referenced in the Senate side, and the other is under the court's inherent authority. Inherent authority expungements are much less common in housing court, but they still exist. And with the language in the Senate bill would kind of limit the effect of this provision to just the statutory expungement and not the common law expungement. So without the cross-reference, it essentially would authorize the housing court to have an inherent authority expungement at the time of the initial eviction. The Senate version would seem to limit that to only a statutory expungement.
Any questions of the testifier? Seeing that, I do have one question. Have you had a chance to talk to anyone from legal aid or multi-housing about these two provisions?
I've talked to legal aid about it, and I used to work at legal aid for about 30 years. I have talked to Ron Elwood about it. I have not had a chance to talk to multi-housing because I didn't see this until.
So we had, so the committee should have gotten a notice or letter or something, an email from Mr. Elwood. And I can't remember Todd's last name from multi-housing, that they had a preference as it pertains to the language as well, but I don't see them in the room, so I just thought I would mention it.
What was their preference?
Their preference was the Senate language. So perhaps you, I would have advised you to talk to both Ron and Todd from Malta Housing to see if you all could come up with a plan, right? Or at least see if you can come to some meeting of the minds, for lack of a better word.
Mr. Chair, I did speak to Mr. Elwood. I didn't have a chance to speak to Mr. Lundquist. My sense is that there are not real strong preferences among the three of us either way. My sense is that there's a slight preference on legal aid toward the Senate version and a slight preference on my side for the House version. My understanding is that the preference for the Senate version has to do with more specificity.
We're just talking about you.
Here they are.
All right. So. Thank you. Mr. Elwood, can you come forward for us, please? Literally, see? And Todd, if you want to come forward as well. We were just talking about the housing language that's in both the House and Senate, and if you can just talk briefly about that and identify yourself for the record, that'd be great.
Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Thank you, Mr. Interim Chair, Substitute Chair for the moment, members. Our approach to the language was we thought the Senate language was preferable simply because it had more specificity and cross-referencing the existing statute with respect to existing standards for expungement. We've talked to Mr. Lundquist, which apparently will follow me. Our folks and his folks have agreed that we thought the Senate, our preference was for the Senate language. I understand Mr. McDonough's point, and we didn't look at it from that perspective, but merely from what this intent of this language was supposed to do. And if for that purpose, we thought the specificity to the existing cross-references to the 484.014 made sense.
Representative Hillstrom, I almost called you Senator Hillstrom.
So what do you make of his statement that it would eliminate the court's inherent authority in expungement in the housing area?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, you know, as you probably know, Mr. McDonough was a longtime legal aid lawyer. He headed the housing unit at Legal Aid for a long time. He probably knows more about tenant-landlord law than anybody else in the state. I have nothing but the utmost respect for him and his opinions. So therefore, I'd have to say that may be correct. On the other hand, I think it's the court has inherent authority. It has it. I mean, if the court chose to exercise its inherent authority, I don't think this would be a bar. The court may not choose to exercise his inherent authority with or without this section. But he may be right that it may chill some in some areas of the state from doing that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe the two of you guys could get together and talk about how you might fix that.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, always happy to talk to Mr. McDonough.
Introduce yourself for the record and
Go
forward.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Todd Lundquist, represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. My comments largely reflect the same as Mr. Elwood's. We believe that this is clear. It does clarify the standard by which the court is applying the expungement record, and it is still upon motion of the defendant. It is applying what is current law.
Can I interrupt you because we have to go up to vote, so can you give us 5 minutes?
Unless they need. I've been running up and down those stairs, and by the time I get up there, they're done. could wear off the hamburger and french fries I had for lunch, but...
I taped the game last night.
What?
I taped the game, and I didn't start watching until 11.
Okay. I was doing this while I was watching it. Well, I took it all out to Bloomington, brought it home, and I came back and turned the game on about 10, so I'm sitting there trying to do this. Yeah. And watch
very
the
distracted.
So should we not tell the story?
No, I stayed up.
Well, you saw the best part then.
Anyone else?
Did you get the overtime, basically?
Yeah. I'm happy that I DVR. You need to record the. Well, plus you need to record the show after it because this blew through the. So you. It's going to be a sad.
You guys did you already have session today?
I don't have to you twice before you leave the bus. That's disappointing.
Well,
overtime.
Based on the series, till you needed that, but it was just like the game didn't take such long. Are the breaks longer than usual?
Between overtime is shorter, I think, because they don't typically sell it.
They
want to resolve it.
Yeah, those breaks have been really long.
Well, they start late too. Even at home, they were starting at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, there's just that one.
We're doing the same thing on Friday. It doesn't start. It's in Chicago, but it doesn't start until 8 o'clock.
Yeah, that's
Thursday. Yeah, what time did you guys start?
First.
Yes.
Okay. I'm in the state.
Oh, he's driving me.
Yes, that's right.
5 hours. I'm pretty sure yesterday.
You heard that.
I don't know if I mentioned it, but I'm actually leaving for the week.
What
do
you have to do?
Saturday, I don't come back on Friday. I'm in Brooklyn.
Oh, you could have been in New York.
Port Hamilton.
What? For what?
Port Hamilton.
Right by the bridge?
Marathon Club.
Yeah, we do our fitness tests right along the river at the gate.
I
leave Saturday morning and come back Friday evening.
What if you came on and you got cancer?
Starts on Saturday, ends on Friday.
I'm isolated and you can't take anything else.
Hopefully this will be a behind-the-scenes type thing.
Really?
But Matt will.
Yeah.
Buddy Matt, he's got my back. He's got my back. Unless he doesn't. This is not a good time for having my back.
You bring Becky in.
Yep. Cover and self-tracking.
That's all right. Oh. Ken's doing softballs and I'm doing exoneration. So we all like to mix it up a little bit.
Exoneration.
I am part of
resolution.
They're awesome. I mean, they're pretty close, considering how many times I've won.
The advocates are massaging them.
Yeah.
They're working out the kinks, so I think.
Start out with the
office
and then
one up. I mean, if you're controlling that, I definitely think.
The house looks like they massage.
How you control it.
I got through the first couple of pages. Just doing sort of a pre-comparison.
I'm not kind of at the group, I assume it's a couple of them, but I don't think they're going to be.
I don't think so. Yeah, I know. Yeah,
Am I supposed to go? Yeah, I'll email it to you.
Does it cost, or what do you do?
I'm guessing it probably won't.
Really important.
Oh, okay.
thanks.
Well, yeah, I mean, sounds interesting. Well, we're not quite as afraid of law enforcement over here. Oh, I see what you mean, yeah. Yeah. Law enforcement testified against it yesterday, but they weren't real strong. They weren't real super duper opposed. I think they were doing what they had to do. Bob was there too. Oh, you're majority leader, yeah. Okay.
Last year, we were in Brooklyn. I was going to have dinner with my niece, who lives near the new arena in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh, right.
Vastly underestimated the size of Brooklyn. thinking that I knew because of the way the freeway goes that you drive from the airport right to Hamilton. I'll start walking and then not thinking I would get there, but I thought I'd get a cab.
Right.
But there really aren't a lot of cabs
in that area. Yeah.
More of a suburban type area when you're down.
When you're down that far.
Yeah, so they kind of people drive in and they leave. They don't just hang out. But I was ended up got a cab, but it was a cab ride. $3 subway home.
You were Dennis Dasson? Yeah, weren't you for Lindsay Stein? Yeah, I kind of remember that.
Live and learn.
Brooklyn and Queens are really.
Yeah, I kind of think she did. You remember that.
Hey, you got the map in your office, don't you?
Well, I have my subway map, but it's not on the wall anymore. It's fine. Actually, I never spent 2 years
in research and then director of all three divisions, research, media, and constituent services for 8 years.
I knew
they started out as researcher in business and labor issues.
Do you think our kids will light rail?
And then John Marty was staff at the house.
But if you need my
who else? Some others of us.
I'll take it with you.
Can I take a picture of it?
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
It's the only way. It used to be, who?
Suggestion was it just.
What's his name? The one that got to be a judge.
No, well, I know, but I'm, for whoever's got to scan them all. It's like if I'm saving law review articles
for
several. I just rip off the top page, and now we finally got a real Westlaw. After years of, being made, billed for law.
Hacking into house researches.
Yeah, that's right. I've got so much stuff I have to save. I'll read this over the intro.
Okay. We're going into pretty small offices, and then there's not going to be as much memory, so you have to, call
everybody the
most
purge.
Of your files.
That's for 2 years.
Well, until whenever this new space is ready. A year and eight. Well, yeah. I mean, isn't the hope that they can have it? I could run it for the 2016 session. Maybe a little less, but yeah.
So,
is Chris eating the sandwich?
Yeah,
for you?
I've been
thinking
about
the mic.
So that don't involve me.
No, I didn't know that.
Well, in the parking lot. You're supposed to be able to get parking.
20 phone calls to work?
Well, I don't know. Again, Tom's got all this stuff.
Separation of powers.
There's some kind of design. There's going to be, a service.
It seems to be right.
What they did to me to come to the Senate when they decided
to do
it. It looks suspicious.
It's a week full of boom, 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 boom.
I thought maybe we might just be pulling on it.
I'm sure they wouldn't let us do that. But.
So, I mean, that's driven me spoiled before I had seniority at the parking spot.
I mean,
there was 20 steps to the door of the Capitol on the back side there on that lot. No, I have to walk all the way. Every day I'm like, it'll be nicer this summer. then I won't care.
I mean, is that really?
In St. Paul, kind of in the very southwest corner of town. I don't know if you know Highland Village area. So off of St. Paul Avenue. Little neighborhood of 1950s Ramblers.
I guess I
kind of
stand.
Close to the JCC.
Where Rich works now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like
how many times people have to come to the Capitol.
I've seen the bus out here a few times. Oh, Rich is I asked him one time, were you over at the Capitol? No, I wasn't around there. I said, well, I wonder what the heck the JCC bus was doing.
Yeah, they're interested.
Under the transportation building.
He's got kids. Hey, you stay here. Let's just move. Stay in this hearing room until I get back.
Which is what you would be boring.
That's a nice whole area. I mean, it is really accessible to everything. You know, it's pretty, well, the gifts that you're here is really easy. No. The downtown Minneapolis, they have that. My mom lives here. I grew up in it. Really, people out there hear you say,
"Who are they?"
The
I just don't want to make it confusing if we have a certain standard. Or
yeah,
standard.
And I said, you know, you literally just go around the airport and you get off the road right away, and we're 3/4 of a mile in. So.
Well, that was just a thought.
Yeah, and that's close to the river.
Sure.
Hey, Kathy.
Yeah.
We're both in the mines. What's this now? Or does the authority to do whatever they want
yeah.
to do with
them. So what I was talking to Larry about is what if there was a sentence after a section that says nothing in here?
Yeah.
Not that it would.
Is it,
well, that's what like do you saying, think it's just like saying the legislature can
kind of.
No, they can change the color.
Yeah. Kind of. But I'm just saying, that does it create any problem? Does it satisfy that concern?
Yeah, or something that's pursuant to that
section. Oh, my God.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, just throw that
in. Watch from this.
They have anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah, that'd be great. You're right.
So, under the provisions of section 4 or upon the courts.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. That would
be fine with that.
You would be?
Yeah.
I mean, they have it anyway. It's not, you know, it's not telling them they have something that they. So I don't think that expands. I mean, it certainly doesn't expand it.
Yeah.
They already do it anyway.
Yeah. That's right. I did start thinking about this. I printed out. Yeah. I mean, it's not. My friends get killed and beaten. And he didn't get killed, obviously, but he did.